Welcome to the Total Brain podcast series, hosted by Dr. Evian Gordon, founder and chief medical officer of Total Brain.
Today's podcast is about how your brain's strengths and weaknesses affect your mental health. And I'm delighted to once again have David Whitehouse speaking to us on this topic. Dr. David Whitehouse, MD, PhD, is a Cambridge University undergraduate, a Harvard-trained psychiatrist with over 20 years' experience with leading managed care behavior change companies in the United States. He also has an MBA from the University of Connecticut and a doctorate in theology from Harvard. Well, David, it's great to speak to you again.
Oh, wonderful, Evian.
So before we start, David, let's give some context about where we are so far. So we have really had podcasts that you've participated in on mental health as not being about them and us, but just about us, the destigmatization of mental health, that we're all just fluctuating, all with us during our day, over our lifetime, across the mental health, well-being, peak performance continuum. And we all have the same stuff, basically. You know, it's with our genetics that contribute to ourselves, our bonding, whether it's how we were bonded, whether it's anxious or secure kind of bonding. We all have conditioning, early life stress, life experiences. Increasingly, we're seeing the importance of inflammatory responses and what we eat. The gut biome, we all have these same ingredients. I really found the series, David, as well, on what can people with mental health teach all of us, the authenticity, the sensitivity, creativity, the second sort of phase of our discussions of mental health. Yes, last weekend, you and I focused on stress as the single biggest determinant of well-being in mental health, and stress and negativity in particular. And today, David, the focus will be on capacities, the brain's capacities. And next week, you and I are going to focus on the how. How do you break the negative stress circuits in mental health, the how. But today, capacities. And I suppose let's start off, David, before we get into the details of the 12 total brain capacities and how they can be empowering and central to our insights. Let's just quickly take a snapshot of the core deficits in each of the disorders. I thought we'd talk about five of the seven that we deal with in Total Brain. So anxiety, as we know, the core deficit is this chronic fight-flight activation. In depression, magnifying negativity bias, negativity. In addiction, it's about cravings, how people can deal with cravings. ADHD, of course, task closure and distractions, and PTSD, these traumatic memory intrusions. So as we move, David, to drawing on your experience as a psychiatrist and somebody who's been involved in building mental health programs at such a high level and on such scale, what do you, however, as a clinician, see in your mind with each of these core deficits? What's a single concept for each? If you could take us through each one. Firstly, anxiety. What is the concept you see beyond just the chronic fight or flight?
Well, as a start, I would just like to say, I think to me, the first and most important adjunct that the whole approach to looking at the brain cognitively brings is that the training of psychiatry as part of medicine, for the most part, around syndromes, around the DSM, around approaches to clusters of symptoms that patients express, while incredibly helpful and allowing patients to be placed in groups, to point towards treatments which were most effective for patients who belong to those clusters, we know has still left us struggling. And one of the most significant things I have to admit that happened to me was actually was meeting you and a chance to really begin to understand, to learn, to become a student of the functioning of the brain and the way it relates to emotional ill health. And to have seen how valuable that is in being able to transform the lives of patients, and what a gift it was to meet with you. Because while the symptoms have been very helpful, and while they might have been helpful in psychopharmacology, we have waited to really look at how does an individual's interaction between their brain and the world they live in, the way it guides them in their interpersonal relationships, the way it helps them or hinders them when they feel threatened or stressed, the way it disrupts their capacity at work to focus and get things done so that their lives become miserable, become difficult. To be able to understand that in terms of capacities and to give them, especially through tools like Total Brain, a way of actually putting a metric on that so that they could see where they are, compare themselves with people of the same age and the same gender, where people are functioning well where they should be, and so they had a target to aim at, has been transforming. It's been transforming for patients who began to understand themselves for the first time. Instead of this kind of mysterious previous vision, the vision that in part my training grew up with, the kind of psychoanalytic vision where a patient faced one way and a therapist faced another way, and one spoke and the other one interpreted. And there wasn't the same level of insight and moment-to-moment actively joining and changing that now takes place in a fully informed cognitive therapy. It's a different world, and it's so much more valuable as a clinician to be able to incorporate both.
Yeah, thank you, David. That's very kind of you to say. Our joint journey has been quite remarkable and certainly transformative for me too. But it's such a great summary that you've just articulated. I summarized the core deficits in each of those disorders and your point about how now we have a 20-minute assessment, for example, in Total Brain, whereby you can get a snapshot of the key capacities that are driving, supporting, underpinning those core deficits. And your point about extending the symptoms that are the kind of current Bible of psychiatry to adding, complementing them with capacities is a game changer, not just from Taylor Rain's point of view, but for psychiatry. And clearly that'll be is being increasingly coupled with genetics and the other kind of insights from neuroimaging. But capacities provide the scalable, quickest way to get that complement to symptoms. So with your wonderful context about that, let me just briefly spend 2 minutes restating the framework that we use in Total Brain about the brain's 12 key capacities. So the simplest story narrative about this over years is that when I set up the Total Brain International Database, it was to standardize and integrate all information about the brain. And what emerged from that was that, very aligned, obviously, to the scientific literature, that there are two modes of thinking, non-conscious emotions and conscious rational thinking. And secondly, that safety first is the key organizing principle of the brain. Safety. And of safety primarily is non-conscious. It's a non-conscious rapid evaluation of the cues that are going to make us feel safe or move towards reward. We're going to protect ourselves if something is unsafe and move towards something if there's a reward. So that's the essence of it, as you know, David. And then there were these four key functions that sort of each have three capacities: the emotion, feeling, cognition, and self-control. So I just want to take a minute to create a visual picture maybe of how emotions drive feelings, drive cognition, and self-control brings it all together. What do I mean by that? So let's start off with emotion. So emotions are simply our brain's non-conscious rapid processing of cues. So the threatening cues can be in our environment or more increasingly social cues. Like if people smile at us and they're inauthentic, it's a social cue of a mismatch. So emotions, our intuition, happen non-consciously, and they are essentially shortcuts that the brain has evolved to determine whether something is threatening or rewarding. And those emotions happen in a fifth of a second. And then our body feels the impact of them, like if it's fear, we can feel our heart rate rise, our breath increase, and those are our feelings, or sweating. That is our feelings. So the emotions are driving those feelings that start being consciously aware of them at about half a second. And then it also in parallel drives, of course, our cognition. And everybody knows what cognition is: our memory, our focus, our planning. So that is the kind of simple picture. I like to think of it, David, in terms of time. So the emotions are happening quickly, these snapshots. They're triggering how we feel. And then our brain is starting to rationalize and consciously determine whether those snap judgments, those biases of emotion and intuition, are aligned with the actual circumstance. Self-control is really how we regulate all of this. So that's the show, in a sense. That's the essence. That's the framework. And I think with the framework, it's empowering. The more people have a framework, the better they can use it. And so when we look at a total brain report with each of the three capacities for emotion, our awareness of emotion, how much of it is negativity biased, or even what's our default emotion? Is our default emotion fear or anger or sadness or happiness? Those are the three capacities. In feeling, the three capacities are stress, anxiety, and mood control, because it's about our feelings. And in cognition, as I mentioned before, the three capacities are attention, memory, and planning. And in self-control, the three capacities are how we deal with negativity, how resilient we are, and how well we connect socially. Those are our core capacities, David, that seem to drive the kind of workhorses of the brain. And so it's pretty straightforward when we see a report of those 12 capacities. The people that I see who use that report the most effectively start off by looking at the safety first organizing principle. How does stress, the stress capacity, link to memory or anything? So that's the first level. The second is how well does the emotion and the cognition align? And then how well do you self-regulate? That's my context, David. So using that refresher, that 2-minute refresher, would you mind taking us through each of those disorders about how you would see and point people in the direction of kind of complementing their symptoms, the understanding of symptoms with those capacity scores, that kind of framework? Maybe let's start off with anxiety.
So I think with anxiety, almost universally, the thing that people describe most is their awareness of the physical experience of anxiety. That when you ask them, when you become anxious, do you become aware of physical changes? And they can say yes, and they talk about their breathing and their heart rate. And then when you say, does realizing that your heart is beating faster or you're beginning to get anxious, does that make you more anxious? And they are very well aware of the circuit of anxiety that then drives them into a more anxious state, which makes everything beat harder and faster, makes them more aware of that, and they are rapidly taken over and hijacked by the whole experience. And when they look at how can that be measured, and their first experience is it couldn't possibly be stopped. Maybe you can take a drug. Maybe they've tried, actually. Maybe that's one of the reasons they first tried substance use of various types to calm it. Their first belief is the only way this can be controlled is exogenously by a substance. They don't necessarily think that talking can make it better. They don't necessarily think, certainly, things like breathing could make it better. Those concepts are completely unknown to them. So being able to show them what happens when they breathe, what they can control this system, that they have capacities that no one ever has explained to them because they did not know they were there. They have never used, and they have never practiced, because they know nothing about how they themselves can seize that moment and control things. It's completely eye-opening to them. And I think then when you say that not only does that, exactly as you've said, it is driven so fast and happens so much that that will then drive your thinking, but at the same time, the thoughts go up into your frontal brain for threat appraisal. And then there, as we've talked about, you get to the issues of bias, which can take us then perhaps on to depression. But I think until I had seen the power of looking at things like facial recognition of emotions and realizing that depending upon one's emotional state, one could see in neutral faces biased anger, bias towards depression or sadness, and that a person who suffered from depression would see sadness in many more faces than a regular person. The individual themselves is not aware of that. They're not aware of the unconscious bias. And to be able to kind of put some marker on that and track that is amazing to them. And say, we're going to look at that. One of the things you're doing is precisely that.
Yeah, that's a great summary of really expanding upon what we were talking about last week, David, about stress, now anxiety, and the fight, flight, chronic activation, and how people can think about their own strengths and limitations in dealing with that in real time through their measurement and tracking of capacities. It's a great example for anxiety, supplementing the symptoms with a deep understanding and personalization of capacities. So let's move on to depression. Depression is, of course, a different kind of level of challenge in some ways. And I'm fascinated by, of course, we said magnifying negativity bias as the core, but I am intrigued by the way Martin Seligman describes the idea of learned helplessness in depression. And he mentions the three P's. I think they stood for, I think, personalization, that sort of everything's our own fault, pervasiveness, that it's going to rule every aspect of our lives, this negativity, and sort of like a permanence, that it's going to be going on like this forever. So what is the cognitive underpinnings in your mind, David, that are kind of interlinked with those sort of massive focus and preoccupation with negativity and depression?
So sadly, I think some of them is, we're always fascinated by our brains. I think the brain actually at times is kind of prone to laziness. And one of the dangers of a lazy brain is that in order to make life simple, it definitely wants to generalize. And while that is extremely good because there is much value in generalizing so that every situation does not have to be individually analyzed, but the brain can very quickly and for safety say, ah, this belongs to this set of circumstances. That is clearly a wonderful safety mechanism. It can very quickly categorize, and if accurate, moves one into the right behavior, moving away from something or moving towards something. But the danger of that is it generalizes for speed. And so in terms of favoring speed over accuracy at times, it generalizes. And so with this depression, we have in cognitive therapy, we have a series of cognitions that we can take, and we may begin. People tend to like me at first, but after they get to know me, I disappoint them. And while that may have happened on one occasion, may have happened on two occasions, it sadly gets put into the brain as an operating rule and is generalized to then this would apply on all occasions. And the trouble is the brain, in its laziness, then looks for all the confirming instances rather than the exceptions. So it confirms even further the negative bias and says, this indeed is the case. Look, all these other circumstances have endorsed that fact. And it forgets all the ones that actually challenge that statement. And in the depressed patient, concepts like generalization become incredibly dangerous, negative, and defeating. And only when they're challenged and brought back. But it is kind of understanding that the brain developed these capacities in part as part of its safety mechanism. It makes a huge sense to recognize patterns for speed of safety. But there are dangers within that. And the personalization is some extraordinary thing because although the threat determination, initially the majority of threat is from outside, the brain also analyzes to what extent we ourselves were the cause of the threat. And then we'll look at what did we contribute to create the negative situation. And there becomes a personalization, again subject at times to distortion, which results in these feelings of guilt and of shame, which is that the very negative that is causing us stress and from which we are trying to get away is in fact originated from inside ourselves. And we are the cause of our own threat.
Yeah, that's a great summary, David, of that interconnection between the symptoms and the capacities. Yep, it's a really very elegant, dynamical process and super nuanced and yet very straightforward in the way it can lead to those cycles of decline.
And I have to thank you for something else. When we first met, we talked in the language of, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could democratize the brain? And I think that to me, one of the things talking about the capacities can begin to do is to try and demystify the brain to people so that they can take back ownership of their own brains in a much more understandable way. In one sense, the pure psychiatry of symptom complexes leaves the whole theory of causality out. And so it's like you have this illness, this is the right treatment. Why is this treatment? How is it working? Though that is left unsaid and mysterious. And so I still feel at a loss, disempowered, when somebody explains the capacities and how the capacities may have been hijacked but can be restored, I begin to take back my own brain. I begin to own my brain. I begin to shape the health and the wellness as much as I can with the help of a guide. Some people can do it by themselves. Other people, it will get so far offline that it will need a guide to help them bring it back. But understanding capacities changes things.
It's exactly what's the goal, and it is fascinating, and I'm very grateful for you to help articulate this in that way where there is the empowerment of self-insight, but also the ability to use these insights in conjunction with the clinician as needed or as required or as chosen. So that's a great example, and it really draws up the next example, David, which is a really challenge of dealing in the moment with addiction of cravings. And of course, what is your context about the manner in which the capacities can be better served to deal with this incredibly powerful hijack of cravings in the moment?
So I think that one of the things that we tend not to be aware of, anybody who suffers from addiction is not aware of, is the extent in which once the brain and the reward system is hijacked, that the cognitive circuits, the day-to-day functioning of things like working memory and executive function are transformed and hijacked. And that in fact, what we have come to realize that under these cravings, unless there is some evidence that those capacities are beginning to come back and those circuits are restoring, the opportunity for relapse is exceptionally high. So while we teach people about the power of cravings, about how, again, this time it's the kind of distortion of memory, that the memory of what the substance did, that in that moment, that temporary moment of perceived peace, of perceived relief from threat, now attached to a wider set of memories, the place where we used to drink, the person from whom we used to get our drugs, that we have attached all these positives. And while we think we're doing so well because we are steering clear of the substance itself, we don't understand that the functioning of that memory, of those distorted memories, is to pull us back to memories of what the alleged positive of addiction was, the relief that it gave. And that we need the cognitions, the working memory tests that we do, the executive function tests that we do, show whether we're winning that battle and tell us when people are vulnerable and we need to see them more often, create a much more extensive support system. They become much better tests of how a hijacked brain is functioning than asking people, are you doing okay? Are you attending these various groups?
And it's interesting, David, the literature so supports that there's a lot of replicated papers now showing that with cognitive deficits, you increase the likelihood of dropout, and with the number of mental health conditions plus resilience, self-regulation increases the likelihood of relapse. So there's a really rich literature now that's emerging to support that. So before we end off with ADHD, would you mind just briefly giving us the similar context for post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD? To me, that intrusion of memories seems to be so disruptive to cognition. What is your context in that regard?
I think that people with PTSD know so well, which is that when some memory circuits are so entrained, so the grooves of them so deep and so resilient, it seems to the person, to any adaptation or questioning, that they run like repeated television shows again and again and cannot be stopped. The opportunity to look at how other areas of brain functioning can be trained to act as distractors, how autonomic arousal can be lessened through things like breathing and heart rate variability. The number of times I've had patients who said, I cannot even think about cognitive therapy approaches to PTSD or anything else because my level of physical arousal is just so high that all I do is have the physical perception of being back and living in that memory again. And the only way of interrupting that film is to break that physical level of arousal, that you can suddenly take the color intensity, which is shooting across the screen, and you can dampen it. And if you dampen it, maybe they consider an alternative and different cognition. They can move to something else. But until you give them that, the minute that memory hits, they're stuck in that position. So again, looking at all their cognitive capacities and its relation to sympathetic activity, as capacities, can really drive personal intervention.
Yeah, it's also such a good example, David, about why it's useful to have a framework about the brain in post-traumatic stress disorder. It's another example of what people with mental health can teach all of us, but also be empowered by the biology of memory, that we all know that normal memory starts off by getting encoded in the hippocampus, which converts short-term to long-term memory. But emotional memories, like traumatic memories, they don't go through the hippocampus. They go through the amygdala, and they get more deeply wired. Neural networks that fire together, wire together, and that is why those traumatic memories are literally more deeply wired and more easily able to be intrusive in the manner in which you have described. Biology, psychology, context, bringing together symptoms and cognition. Yes, there's a lot of details, but there's also the essence that is enormously empowering, as you've described. Last but not least, David, ADHD is different in its own ways in the sense, of course, it's a problem with focus and distraction. But as Glenn Elliott in his podcast on ADHD highlighted, it's about task closure. And then there's also the subgroup of 20% who have high anxiety. So how do you see the cognitive insights empowering people with ADHD to help better learn and help better control with this remarkable distractibility?
So I think one of the interesting things to me is that as a physician, in almost every aspect, you try to get some capacity to measure the extent that something is changing. So we don't just say to people, do you have high blood pressure, focused by what? You feel your heart beating in your chest. You flush more easily than other people or whatever. We actually take the blood pressure and we watch it changing, and we can see it change under different circumstances. So with something like attention, we can measure it under certain situations. And that is prior to kind of thinking about easy ways to do that, more simplified, more capable ways, such as using online or cell phone data to do it. I just ask people at work, how is your concentration? And they'd give some generalized number, some generalized capacity. But to really help them understand the differences between is what affects you at work a problem of attention? Is it a problem of concentration? Is it a problem of memory? They have no capacity to differentiate those things in the lived experience. And it is only when you look at those capacities and begin to measure them as different capacities and relate them to things like anxiety, that you can begin to measure severity, degree, and situational circumstance in a way that allows them to make sense of and so join you in trying to ameliorate those conditions. So to me, I think that I am dumbfounded by how much one before treated blind based on almost no information about capacities at all, but based on self-report as the sole marker of what was the target.
It's a great way to end, David, and you just helped articulate in so many ways, at so many levels, how capacities complement symptoms, but also the power of repeating those assessments every month or as regularly as needed to see objectively how things are getting better, staying the same, getting worse, and using those objective insights to help personalize, empower, and shape a better outcome. And I'm also excited to soon be also seeing Total Brain add heart rate variability measures using the phone and using mobile phone. And that will further add this notion, David, that I'd like us to end off with before as a pointer also to next week when we discuss the how. And I think not only have you summarized the power of capacities, but also pointed to this distinction between dealing with the how we circuit break in the moment, the 50,000 thoughts we have a day, but how do we actually circuit break those negative hijacks that you've described in each disorder and better align our cognition to support a more positive, more flexible decision making, a switching out of fight flight into a more calm, flexible state. How do we do that in the moment? And I just want to point to the big distinction that we'll be talking about next week between the in the moment strategies about the how to circuit break and align the capacity and symptom insights with solutions versus the more structural changes of solutions, the meditation, cognitive behavior therapy, which I know you'll be talking about in depth, exercise, nutrition, which are going to be all future podcasts. So that is the pointer that I would like to end off with, that it's about in the moment. That's the same deficit, David, the same gap in psychiatry, in everything to do with the brain as a system that existed with not having capacities center stage for scale. I think that same gap is not focusing on in the moment. How do you for real break those negative thoughts? Not in theory, not la la land lists of things to do. How do we do it? So that's hopefully the challenge for next week, David. No pressure. But let's end off maybe with one takeaway from you that you think you'd like to offer for this podcast about strengths and weaknesses the essence of capacities.
So to me, the one takeaway is it is almost incumbent on all of us to have some understanding of the capacities of our brain as the first step, regardless of whether you're suffering from emotional illness or not, of truly understanding yourself. It is a chance to look in the mirror and to know yourself at a different level than you have known yourself before, in a way that allows you to own yourself in a different way than you have before. And who would deny anybody the opportunity for that?
Well, wonderful as always, David. Thank you so much. And same time next week.
Same time next week. Thank you, Evian. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks, David. Speak to you soon. Bye.